Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
Hello, hello. Happy Thursday. Happy Juneteenth to those who celebrate. Although I have been told that Juneteenth is for everyone because it is the day that all Americans were free, at least legally. But yes, I am very excited for our colleagues and teammates from 101.7 The Truth down at the parade and the festival. I will probably sneak out of here after today's show and go check it out. I hope you find yourself celebrating as well. If there's a local parade or event near you, or come down to Milwaukee's, because Milwaukee's is one of the oldest. It's the oldest TIFF. There you go. It's from the first one started in 19. It can't be the oldest, because when I read about this in Journal Sentinel, it said Juneteenth celebrations in Milwaukee first took place in 1972. And according to previous Journal Sentinel reports, the celebration began when Margaret Rogers, who was a then staff member at Northcott Neighborhood House in the Harambee neighborhood, told others in 1971 how much she enjoyed a Juneteenth celebration in Georgia. She had gone to.
It is the oldest continuously operating parade in the country.
It's those little words sometimes that needs. well, yes. So that is very exciting. It's also the 160th anniversary of Juneteenth is this year. So that is a long time. But I woke up today. I know I've been trying not to be on this kick of not sleeping with my phone in my room so I don't go to bed scrolling and wake up scrolling. I did not do that yesterday. So I did check Twitter this morning, and a fairly popular, notorious MAGA tweeter wrote something along the lines of, no one knew what it was before 5 years ago. First of all, that's not true. As we just said, it's 160 years old. It's been celebrated for generations. Now, I will say, I did not learn about this in school. I didn't learn about Juneteenth in school. I learned about it, like most nice white people, from the show Black-ish in 2017. And so I don't know how many other people, I think my parents were in that same boat. I think a lot of us were in that boat. And that was the point of the episode. If you remember the show Black-ish, that was very popular for its run, that portrayed a very, pretty affluent black family in LA. And so many of the conversations that happened on that show were through the lens of race while using very biting humor. And that was so much of what this episode was about. If you have not seen this episode, I highly recommend it, because it was very funny. It was a history lesson. And they had incredible musical guests, because the whole episode was kind of like a Hamilton-esque. If you remember, that was also the height of Hamilton's popularity around 2017. And so this was how the show started, with a little Schoolhouse Rock meets Juneteenth. All right, Jazz, help me out here. If anything that I just said in the first segment of today's show, did it sound super radical?
No.
Someone texted in after I just had our first segment talking about Juneteenth and the show Black-ish and their episode of Juneteenth and how that was the first time I really ever learned about it. And someone texted in saying, turned her off. She's ridiculous, radical, liberal. So if you thought that was a ridiculous and radical, then maybe you should turn it off. Because I think that acknowledging a federal holiday and that it was something that we didn't necessarily learn about, and you learned about it later in life through a sitcom,
I didn't
is
hear
not
about
a radical
it
thing
it
to talk about.
I didn't hear about it until it became a federal holiday. I'm not ashamed to admit it. But.
Yeah. So I thought that was funny as far as how people hear things differently. But I did see this morning because I was interested. Like you said, it's been since 2021 when Juneteenth became a federal holiday. And there has been, I think up as of this year, or maybe it was as of 2024, 4 out of 10 companies give it as a paid holiday off. Our company does. We walked in today and it was a ghost town. Obviously, we're airing live. The truth is still airing live from Juneteenth in downtown Milwaukee. But my sister-in-law was in town last night, and she got to babysit for us while we went to my birthday dinner because she has off today, and she works for a big national corporation. And so, but it was interesting because I was wondering, you know, with the anti-DEI rhetoric that's been predominant since Trump took office, how things would feel or look different for this year. And so USA Today kind of looked into it. And obviously this was, there was this big push in 2020 in the aftermath of George Floyd, and how many more corporations, I think, were being very loud about their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and their support for days like this, for Juneteenth or even for Pride. But and it's interesting because what the summary is that despite a backlash against DEI initiatives, Juneteenth mostly has maintained broad acceptance, and there is a growing number of large employers that are recognizing it as a paid holiday, and that they're just kind of shifting from highly visible displays of support to more internal and lower profile activities. And I wonder how much this is also an allegory for what's happening with DEI programs across the board, as far as maybe we still have them and they're just calling them something different. Because I was talking to a girlfriend who works for an organization that is very, let's say, intimately involved in the business community in Milwaukee. And part of their organization is they kind of get, you know, they interview CEOs, they talk to presidents of companies, kind of get the idea of how anything is affecting them, like whether it's tariffs or different tax bills, et cetera, and just kind of like understanding the sentiment that's happening within the business community. And she told me that they were interviewing them specifically about what changes they've made to their DEI programs with kind of the crackdown coming from this administration. And she didn't give me numbers. I didn't have access to like the official files or anything like that. This was just a conversation. But she said, she was, what surprised me is that most companies are still doing it. They're just calling it something else. And I thought that was super interesting because I think it goes to the point, which a lot of social science tells us, is that diversity is actually good for your bottom line. Like diversity of experience, diversity of thought, having more ideas and different ideas at the table, and being a better workplace for more people is actually an economic strength for companies. And so I think it's interesting that at the opportunity to just kind of drop it, and honestly, not even the opportunity to drop it, like kind of the pressure to drop it, how many companies are still covertly saying, well, we're going to just call it something else and keep trying to hire in a diverse way, have different policies that feel inclusive, because ultimately they know it's good for business. And I don't know. It does to me, as the radical liberal, as our texter called me a couple minutes ago, I do feel like we're in a moment where this is kind of a step forward and two steps back when it comes to being a more inclusive culture. It does kind of feel like we're in a backlash from everything that happened in 2020. But I just can't help but think that we're just going to keep moving forward when it comes to this, because people get exposed to different kinds of people and the other becomes less scary the more that you do that. And I just don't think there's any, like, we're going back into a box. Like, I don't think that we're going to go back, because most people, besides the very loud ones on Twitter, don't actually want that. So that's my thoughts. But when we come back, there is talks of cutting $87 million from the UW system for the next biennial budget. And my question with that is, talk about bringing the ladder up behind you, because a lot of these Republicans who are pushing to cut more funding from the UW system benefited from the UW system. So we'll talk more about that after this on Point Taken. Are we playing some Summerfest music?
Oh yeah, we are.
It's obviously what stage are they on tonight? Are they tonight?
Yeah, it's tonight at the American Family Insurance Amphitheater. That's Def Leppard. Pour some sugar on me.
Def Leppard. Man, I really haven't seen any of the as many of them are still playing. Like AC/DC and not Rolling Stones isn't like an 80s hair band, but some of these older bands who are still out there rocking, I've actually never seen any of them. I've heard they're pretty fun though.
I don't know if I've seen the hair bands. I've seen 80s, I've seen Styx, I've seen Foreigner, but a lot of those bands have.
How were they? Was that fun?
They were all right. I don't feel like they're anything to remember, and especially when you realize a lot of them aren't the original members half the time, so it's kind of interesting. It's like, oh, this guy's been here the longest, 17 years. That's not even how long you've existed, so it's just I don't know.
All right. Well, welcome back. Yes, it is the first day of Summerfest. Midday News is going to be broadcasting live there starting at noon. I am excited for this year's lineup. It is always a fun special gem that we have here in Milwaukee. It's some of the cheapest entertainment, all day entertainment you can find to just go walk the Summerfest grounds and hear so many different kinds of music. So I am looking forward to getting down there as much as I can over the next 3 weekends. So this is not settled yet, but as the conversations continue to happen and the votes are happening within the Joint Finance Committee on our biennial budget, there is, I don't even know if it's rumors, because it was confirmed, but they just haven't actually voted on it yet. But Republicans, who obviously control the state legislature and have the majority on the Joint Finance Committee, are considering cutting funding to the University of Wisconsin system by $87 million. Obviously, in Tony Evers' budget, they wanted to increase funding. Jay Rothman, the president of the UW system, who I think his, if I'm correct, I mean, he was a lawyer or is a lawyer, but I think he is a Republican. I think he thought his ability to go into this role in this position with the relationships he has with elected Republicans, he would have a better shot at negotiating with them. And it does not seem like that has come to fruition. But this would be the largest cut since the 2015-2017 budget, when that was obviously during the Walker years. And then at that point, they cut $250 million. And then in more recent budgets, the UW system has received minor funding boosts, or it's just been flat. And I don't understand, and I get it, because basically if this happens, the likelihood of all of the two-year schools closing, I would imagine, is very high, and potentially even some of the four-year schools. And I do think, when you think about those schools, it is limiting the access for more people to go to college. And, is that the goal? When you think of your kids or your grandkids, I know we talk about the value of a college education versus the trades, but if you can have an affordable option for in-state schools, do we not want to support that? I mean, already, there was a recent report that showed that Wisconsin's public university system is among the worst funded in the nation. So is that what we want? Is that what we're hoping for? And I said this before the break, it's just interesting to me because so many of the people who are voting for this graduated from one of the UW schools, whether it was Madison or Whitewater or River Falls. And I don't know how, most of us, when we think about the schools that we graduated from, want to see them succeed. And it's rare. I don't understand the logic behind wanting to pull the ladder up from underneath you and say, well, not for you. I got my degree from this when it was still a well-funded, gem of, for a long time, the UW system was the model, right, of how other states could fund state schools and a world-class university. And it's certainly not that anymore. And the other thing I just don't understand, because it does seem like it gets back to, and I don't, doesn't seem, Voss has said this. He has said that his caucus supports cuts as a way to encourage more viewpoint diversity. And this was his quote. He said, look, this is not a new topic for Republicans. I think we look and say there is still too much political correctness on campus. We want to ensure that whatever happens on campus, it is a free issue of ideas and that people understand that that's the basis for what the university should be. How does cutting funding encourage that? If someone can explain that logic to me, I am open. I'm open to hearing it. It just sounds like a punishment instead of actually trying to fix the problem that he says is an issue. Welcome back to Point Taken. Now, obviously, there is a lot happening in the news. We're not anymore yet. I was just texting my friend Brian Reisinger, is going to co-host with me on Tuesday. He goes, do you want to have a call today or tomorrow to talk about what we're going to talk about on Tuesday? And I said, no, because who knows what's going to happen over the weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday. But something that you may not have heard of is that the Senate, the U.S. Senate, has passed legislation to establish the first regulatory framework for stablecoins. What is a stablecoin? I am going to find out at the same time as you are, because our guest for the next half hour is David Krause, who is the Associate Professor of Practice Emeritus of Finance at Marquette University. I've interviewed him many times. He is my Bitcoin cryptocurrency expert. So I guess, David, what is a stablecoin?
Yeah, we'll give it a try here. It is a cryptocurrency, but it's different than what we think of as riskier cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or Ethereum or even meme coins.
Okay. So, and there's a hierarchy. Like Bitcoin and Ethereum is actually a block, like supported by blockchain, versus a meme coin is just an idea.
That's correct.
Okay.
So one way to think about someone who might invest in Bitcoin or Ethereum or even a meme coin, those are risky, just like investing in stocks. Now, a stable coin is a form of cryptocurrency, but think of it more like a gift card. I mean, let's use Target as an example.
Okay.
Okay? They issue gift cards. We're familiar with those. Somebody gives you a gift card, and then you can go to a Target store and use that.
And they usually sit in your drawer for years and years and years.
But when you get a $50 Target gift card, it's good for $50.
Yeah.
As long as Target stays in business. And they
can't expire.
So a stable coin acts just like a gift card. It's stable or pegged or fixed in value. Whereas think of a meme coin or Bitcoin being more like Target stock, which can go up and down with the whims of the market.
Okay. So what is the, so it's called the Genius Act. And what would it actually do? Like, what are they passing?
As we know, there has not been much regulation in the world of crypto. This is an attempt to take one segment of the market, the stablecoin market, and develop regulations. Now, that's important because we want this technology to eventually become a more efficient payment platform. I mean, today, it's expensive to move money around.
Yeah, you're constantly paying the bank something.
Credit cards, 1.5% to 3%. Try to move money to another country. You could be paying as much as 5%.
You have to pay for an account, just a checking account that you have to pay for sometimes.
So stablecoins, you know, it's 0.1% the fees to transfer money globally, which is substantially below what the Swiss system charges or what just wire transfer fees are. So the idea of getting a handle on this very large industry, the payment rail as it's referred to, I mean, that's good. We need regulations around that. I mean, we didn't do that in the 1830s and 1840s when we allowed any bank to issue their own currency, because we didn't have a U.S. dollar at that time. And it got very confusing, and banks went bankrupt, and therefore people lost all their money. So we've learned from history to try to create a more stable regulatory system. That's what the Genius Act is.
But does it have any impact on existing cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or Ethereum, or is this a totally different thing?
It does not. It just refers to stable coins. And even that, it only refers to stable coins that are pegged to the U.S. dollar. There's other versions of stablecoins that are pegged to gold or to other currencies or to other crypto. Those are, I'll admit, those are exotic. This is designed to deal with dollar-pegged stablecoins.
Okay, so we should note that this was a bipartisan. So it's going to the House. I know this morning President Trump, I think, Truth Social'd his pressure on the House to pass it as a clean bill and get it through. But it passed in the Senate, and it was bipartisan.
Yes.
Does that surprise you?
It's very surprising. That's only the second bipartisan law or act to be passed by this Congress.
So as far as people who are for the Genius Act, what are the arguments to pass this?
Well, the pros or benefits are it's some clarity,
okay,
it's some regulation. It can strengthen the dollar. We've been concerned for several years about the dollar losing its reserve currency status,
okay,
as China and the euro and other regions of the world gain greater economic power. We still want the dollar to be the strongest currency in the world.
Yeah.
This enhances that.
Okay. And so for people, because Elizabeth Warren was against this.
Correct.
Who obviously her rise in politics was coming out of like trying to root out corruption after the 2008 crash and everything. So for people like Elizabeth Warren and other people who voted against it, what are the arguments against this act?
Well, the slippery slope.
Okay.
You know, because the Genius Act allows anyone, you and I, PayPal, Target, entrepreneurs, banks, tech companies, or just financial institutions to issue stable coins. Her concern was it's going to become so large and unwieldy that it'll be very difficult to regulate so many players. Not that she wants to concentrate all of the power in the hands of a few financial institutions, but this would just open it wide up to almost anyone who wanted to issue a stable coin.
All right, let's take a break really quick. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the Genius Act. We'll get any updates on the Trump family crypto machine. I don't know. And then my husband, who is invested in some crypto heads, he submitted some questions to me before I left this morning. So we'll get to all of that with our guest, David Krause, who is a finance professor at Marquette University. This is Point Taken. Oh, this takes me back to being 25, living in Los Angeles, watching MTV. But of course, this is Natasha Bedingfield, and she's going to be performing tonight at Summerfest at the Briggs & Stratton Big Backyard at 10 p.m. So all of you who are Laguna Beach fans with LC and Kristen and all of them can take you back to your youth. All right. We are talking to David Krause, who is a finance professor at Marquette University and my go-to guy for all things crypto and Bitcoin. And we're talking about the Genius Act, which passed in the Senate, and it provides a framework for stable coins. It's now heads to the House. Do you think that the support is there for it to get passed in as Trump asked for, as a clean bill?
I don't want to say it's a slam dunk, but it's not going to get held up at all.
Do you think it'll also be bipartisan in the House?
Yes, maybe not quite as much so,
okay,
but it'll pass easily, and then Trump is going to sign by Labor Day.
So how does this benefit Trump? Because I know there was a lot. No, I mean that as far as there was a lot of the crypto bros and the people who were very invested in advancing crypto who were on the Trump train, right? And so, and he obviously also, the Trump family, has a meme. Is it a meme coin? Is that how you would identify the Trump coin?
The meme
coins?
Coin is President Trump.
So he has one, and then Melania has one.
Yes. And the stable coin is actually the Trump family.
Oh, so they have a stable coin?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Investors in Abu Dhabi put in over $2 billion. It's now the fifth largest stable coin in the world. It's known as USD1.
Okay. So that, I didn't realize that was a stable coin.
Yes.
Instead of the, because I think the last time we talked, it was more talking about the meme coin aspect and the money that was raised off of
that's
that.
That's correct. They're distant cousins. That's all.
Okay. And so this basically, because he's allowed to keep it, right? And that was part of the provisions in this bill, is that it's now, there's some people who are grandfathered in.
That's correct. What was controversial about this bill when it failed to pass through the Senate a month ago was based on conflicts of interest. And Elizabeth Warren and many others were upset that the Trump family was going to directly benefit from this regulation. There was a compromise made at the committee level where any senator, House member, or president, or their family that had prior commitment and investments would be grandfathered. And when this bill is signed, then after that point, no politician can be involved with the stablecoin industry.
It's interesting that there, I mean, one, it's interesting that there's people who are going to be grandfathered in, but why the emphasis on stablecoin and not the stock market when it comes to our lawmakers and what they can and cannot be invested in?
Don't know. Don't want to go there.
All right. So what is, you said it's the fifth largest stablecoin?
Yes. There are two that most people who participate in crypto know about. Because a stablecoin is, it's the on-ramp to investing in the other cryptocurrencies.
Okay.
You don't write a check and buy Bitcoin. You have to take your cash or money that you do have, and you have to buy a stablecoin. And then that stablecoin is the currency that's used to buy Bitcoin. And if you sell Bitcoin, it gets converted into a stablecoin, which then gets converted into cash at some point. So think of it like as the on and off ramp to the interstate highway of cryptocurrency.
It's a brand new world. When you first started teaching finance, did you ever think that this was going to be where your specialty was going to end up?
No, I didn't think technology. I've always followed technology and marveled at it. I did not think it would occur this quickly. I thought that the early cryptos were simply going to be digital gold.
Okay.
Or as a way to safeguard money without it being tied to a currency.
Okay. Well, so one of the questions that my husband had, and we'll keep the one about Ripple that's a little too much wonky off, but he asked, and I would be interested to see your reaction to this. Like, is the government going to use blockchain to update the financial system eventually?
Yeah, I don't think the government's going to do it. It's occurring.
It's occurring.
I mean, there's public blockchains. You know, that's the infrastructure mechanics or the platform behind these cryptos. But there's private blockchains all over the place. I mean, the supply chains, the medical system in the country, those are operating on very complex information systems that are really very similar to blockchain-based databases. So blockchain as a technology, I know people want to change channels as soon as you bring up blockchain. But blockchain.
But it's but this is the thing. It's like we need to understand. It's like the internet, right? As far as like, always the throwback to, I think it was Brian Gumbel and maybe Katie Couric in that like mid 90s Today Show episode. They were looking at like the internet email. Like, what is this? I don't know. I don't know this email hooey. And so it's like it's something that's happening. And the sooner we can try to understand it and wrap our head around it, probably the better for everyone.
So the question was, will the government do it? No, it's going to occur through private enterprise.
Okay.
Okay. And the guardrails, supposedly by things like the Genius Act, allow those businesses and entrepreneurs to develop, but within guardrails.
Got it. All right. Well, we got to take one more break, and we'll come back with David Krause, who is a finance professor at Marquette University, and another mid-aughts heartthrob, throwing back to the circa 2003, 2004, Ben McKenzie has made a documentary, and I don't know if you've heard about it, but I want to talk about that as far as it's called Everyone is Lying to You for Money, and he did a deep dive into crypto. And so I want to talk a little bit about that after this on Point Taken. We only have a couple minutes left with David Krause, finance professor at Marquette University. So I saw this headline this morning. Were you a fan of The O.C. back in? Did you watch it? So you know who Ben McKenzie is, the actor who was the heartthrob. So he has a new documentary that just premiered at South by Southwest London, and it's called Everyone is Lying to You for Money. And it is, he has been on a crusade, basically, against crypto. I think he's kind of, during COVID, if I understand, he was looking at different ways of like things to get interested in, and he went down this rabbit hole of the cryptocurrency industry, and his theory is that it is just a huge scam. And apparently, like, the documentary itself is very, very good. But in a, like we said, a crypto-friendly environment, is it going to get a distributor? I don't know. But as far as we've just talked about, now there's legislation moving forward to regulate this, to normalize this. And then there is also so much unknown about people just getting scammed. Where do you, as someone who studies this, where do you fall right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. First of all, the classical economists, there are many people who do believe that it's a scam.
Yeah.
Because it's unlike any asset we've ever seen. There's no dividends or interest that are kicked off. There's no ownership. There's nothing tangible. There are scams, no doubt about it. As far as meme coins, I'd say 95% of those are just rug pull scams to try to extract money. Ponzi schemes, pyramid schemes, call them what you will. There are legitimate cryptocurrencies that support blockchain that we talked about before. And they will survive. They will have value. Difficult to value. This is not like a stock or a bond. So it challenges people like myself to do that. I think stable coins are where the public will begin to start utilizing these. Not going to happen overnight. A lot of issues the Genius Act doesn't address yet. But we become very comfortable using Venmo, using
PayPal.
PayPal just launched a stable coin within the last week. And if you've noticed their commercials, they're starting to promote its usage more in a digital sense. And I think if you watch closely in the next couple of months, you'll start seeing the PayPal stablecoin being advertised.
There you go.
So is it legitimate? Yes.
It is. All right. Yeah. Well, we'll have to have you back as everything develops. David Krause, thank you so much for joining us today.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Psych, it's just Kristen Bry. We still have a couple more shows before Steve gets back from Scotland. But actually, I should say this now. I am also gone tomorrow, so you're going to be having Tracy Johnson fill in and mediate between Bill and Joe. And then I will be back Monday. And like I said, our friend Brian Reisinger will be with me all day Tuesday, which I'm really looking forward to. And then Steve will be back on Wednesday. But before we do our typical Thursday edition with Jeremy Janine on all things Milwaukee, I'm not going to call it a rant, but it may turn into one. We'll see where this goes. But Charlie Kirk, founder of Turning Points USA, gummiest smile on the block. They recently had their 10th Turning Point USA Young Women's Leadership Summit in Dallas, Texas. And, you know, I'm not their target market. they're not trying to get me to come to these things. And I was trying to think of it, like, I've been to things on the other side of the political spectrum that is targeted towards women, that is certainly much more on the left liberal side of things, whether it was work focused and career focused or politically focused, like Women's March type things. But, you know, to each their own. And that is very much the feminism that I was taught, is that we have options. And that is the goal as a woman, is that you should have options for a lot of different things. And so I know that Charlie Kirk's whole thing is to make viral content, right? It is to say things that get people either fired up or to either agree with him or to vehemently disagree with him. And so to a certain extent, even replaying some of the clips from this conference means I am playing into the attention economy that he is such a skilled person maneuvering within. And so the bigger video that I'm seeing that I'm not going to play just because it's a little long, but there is the one that's grabbed more headlines is a 14-year-old girl comes up and asks Charlie Kirk a question, because it's kind of a Q&A session about she says she wants to go into political journalism and getting his opinion on going to college. And he then starts saying what he usually says as someone who did not graduate from college, that college is a scam, but that the value for women to go to college is to bring back the MRS degree, being the Mrs. degree, right? You go to college to find a husband. And, you know, a lot of people are reacting to that. The part that I wanted to play for everyone is at a different point during the weekend, he and his wife were doing a Q&A around relationships. And this is a little bit of this is his wife's name, Erica. So this is Charlie Kirk and Erica Kirk.
Raise your hand if you had to choose between amazing career, amazing family. You have to choose. Who here would choose amazing career? Raise your
hand. That's fine if you do. Please. That's fine. Like, seriously, please raise your hand.
There's a couple hands. Amazing family. All the other hands got it. Okay. So for everyone that rose the hand of amazing family, how many of you every single day it's your purpose for being is finding a husband then? Every hand should then go up. But I thought you said you wanted an amazing family. You have to prioritize and aim at what you want the most. I might be the only speaker that says this these next couple of days.
You just have to make sure that you find the right...
I know, but you have to prioritize it.
Right? I know, but you can't be like... You can't be like a heat-seeking missile where you're like... You see a guy in the back room and you're like, hi. Like, you can't... there's like some nuance. I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Actually, that was a pretty funny joke in his wife's part. And so, first of all, my reaction to that is... It's not a false... It is such a false dichotomy as far as having to choose one or the other. And I speak from personal experience that you can have both. And then he goes on to say, to put this pressure on you as far as when you should be married by.
If you're not married by the age of 30, you only have a 50% chance of getting married. And if you don't have kids by the age of 30, you have a 50% chance of not having kids. You should know that.
You know what also is true? If you get married in your teens or in your 20s, you are much more likely to get divorced. Couples who marry in teens have a 38% risk of divorce. Those who got married between 20 and 24 had a 27% risk. If you wait until 25 to 29, it goes down to 14. And if you're like me and you wait until your 30s, it goes down to 10%. There's so many things that happened at that over the weekend from that conference that I have opinions about. But I will just say this, and I will say from the personal experience, as someone who got married at 36, if I would have married the person I was dating when I was 26, I absolutely would have been divorced. I absolutely would have been miserable. And I even say this as far as, had I met my now husband, because it was actually an opportunity. We're both in LA at the same time. We didn't know each other. But I sometimes think about that. I'm like, oh, what would have happened if we had been at like the same bar in LA circa 2004, 2006? And it still probably wouldn't have lasted. Because he was a different person when he was in his 20s. And I was a different person when I was in my 20s. And what makes our relationship so great now, and I would put any money in the world that I have one of the healthiest relationships you could find, is that we were more mature. And we knew ourselves better. And we had gone through a lot of life before we actually met. And so if you get married young, great. But don't this fear-mongering that you have to do it before you're 30 is just so wrong. And it goes back to, like I said in the beginning, like the feminism I was taught was about having options. And I feel like it's been skewed into this thing that like feminism is teaching girls to not want an amazing family and to only want a career. And that is absolutely not true. And I feel like as I just reflected on my birthday yesterday, I'm just like everything I have in life is because I had options and because I kept following my gut instinct, and that I didn't have to fit into a box. And so I just so much think that this rhetoric that happens at this conference is just trying to put women back in a box and telling them that's the way it should be. And that's certainly not what I'm teaching my daughter. All right. When we come back, end of rant, we will talk about things happening in and around Milwaukee with Jeremy Janine from Urban Milwaukee. So stay with us. All right. Is it decided? Is this Jeremy's walk-up music from now on?
I guess so. Here we are.
Are you feeling happy with this choice? Confident?
We're closer to free.
Is it better than Billy Idol?
I, kind of like the Billy Idol in this weird way that I would never listen to that song in any other context.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe we'll play that one next. All right. That is the voice of Jeremy Janine from Urban Milwaukee. As always, we love having you on Thursday to get our fill of Milwaukee news. And to start off with, we're getting another timber tower.
Yes, a mass timber tower.
A mass timber tower. And it's kind of fun to say.
Why is that distinction important? It's a completely different building material than concrete and steel. Most towers are actually built out of, you might think it's steel, but they're concrete. Mass timber is a man-made product. It kind of mimics what was old growth forests. So 200 years ago, we had these amazingly thick and old trees that they were just bigger. We had better lumber back then. And then in the next ensuing 100 years, we cut it all down. So mm-hmm. now we have to kind of fake it. And mass timber fakes it by combining layers of wood in different directions. And you end up with a product that's really light, is really strong, and if it's in a fire, it doesn't burn the whole way through. It chars. And if you're looking for like a local example of that, if you go back, ooh, it might be like 10 years now, the Trinity Church fire, or really any church fire, because so many churches are so old, they have the traditional, the organic mass timber. When it burns, you see the structure of the church still there mm-hmm. because the wood is just so thick it doesn't bend through. So it might actually, like at a really high temperature, it's possibly safer than steel. And there's now increasing fire safety tests. So all that is to set the stage. Milwaukee has the tallest one of these buildings in the world in Ascent, 25 mm-hmm. stories, apartment tower, open 2022. We're now getting another one. It's going to break the record, 31 stories. It's called Neutral Edison. Again, it's a luxury apartment building. But it's not going to be the tallest in the world because in between Neutral Edison being completed and Ascent opening in 2022, this building is under construction in Australia that is going to blow the roof off the record and is even taller yet. Okay. And it's made out of mass timber.
So it'll be the tallest in the country.
Tallest in the Western Hemisphere, which somehow seems like a less sexy definition.
And so it is a different development company than who built the Ascent.
Yes. So Ascent was built by Newland Enterprises, a Milwaukee company that has built buildings out of virtually every building material you could. This new company, Neutral, was the Neutral Project based out of Madison, launched in 2020. They just completed their first building in Madison. It's a mass timber building. They're now building a building in Milwaukee. They have another one, I believe, under construction in Madison, and they're looking in all kinds of other markets. They seem very adept at raising money. They have a big national focus to develop these buildings, whereas Newland has really specialized in Milwaukee and is now trying to branch out with their mass timber product.
Not to ask the obvious, but do we need another luxury apartment building?
Well, are the
ones that we have full?
Yes and no.
Because I've been told the couture is only at 50%.
Well, and so that was the first question I wanted to ask Nate Helbach, who's the CEO of the Neutral Project after the groundbreaking on Monday, is what makes you think you're going to be able to lease this? And he pointed, and I think he makes a good argument. He pointed at Northwestern Mutual's 777 building, mm-hmm. which is Loopy and Iris is on the first floor if you're trying to anchor it. That building, it was 30-some stories. It kind of blew open Milwaukee's luxury housing market. It sent up a signal that, hey, Milwaukee has an appetite for this based on how fast it leased up. Then Ascent came along, and Ascent leased up pretty fast. But what happened next, and this is Helbach's argument, is the Couture and 333 Water opened at the same time. So you doubled the amount of supply, and you didn't change the demand. And I think if you break it down, there's an appetite. You could lease about 10 luxury brand new apartment units per month. Well, you double the amount of supply that you get 50% full. You would argue, put them together, they'd be full if it was just one building. So the crux of his argument is in 2 years, when my building is finished, there'll be no other new supply on the line and I will be able to lease my building. Now that's a bet he's making with his investors. We will see how that plays out, but he at least has some rationale for how it works.
All right, let's take a break quickly and come back and talk about which alderman opposes this, right?
Yes.
There's some contention on this. All right. He is Jeremy Janine. I am Kristen Bride. This is Point Taken. Stay with us. This is your Billy Idol, right?
There we go.
There we go. All right. Jeremy Janine is with us to talk about all things Milwaukee. And we were talking about what will be the country, the Western Hemisphere's tallest mass timber building that has broke ground officially.
Has broke ground officially. It actually started a couple months ago, but they had a party on Monday.
But not everyone is happy about this, including Alderman Bauman.
Yes. Yeah, so downtown Alderman Robert Bauman, he represents the near west side as well. It's not that he's not happy about what Neutral is doing on the riverfront site, the 31-story building, tallest in the Western Hemisphere. No there seems to be no opposition there. In parks, it's all private money. And so when we talked before about like, well, what is the risk? The risk is to the investors, not to the city.
Yeah.
And actually, if you're a renter and that building goes vacant, that's probably a positive to you because it means there's more supply. But anyways, where the issue is across the street, the Marcus Center parking garage. It's Matt Wild of Milwaukee Records' personal snow pile thing every year that he gets a joke about. That's a roughly 2.5 acre site. It's actually owned by the city and then leased to the Marcus Center.
Okay.
And the city knows and has known for like 2 decades now, that's not the best use of the site, to only have a parking garage on a full block site. So they want to redevelop it, and they put out a request for proposals. And last August, they announced that Neutral, hey, we're going to advance their plan. And actually, in Neutral's plan is what would be the tallest mass timber building in the world, 55 stories tall, $700 million. Sounds really great, except Alderman Robert Bauman was the first person to raise the red flag and be like, well, that's the third phase of this project, and you haven't built anything yet. And you're going to do 3 more phases that are even bigger than what you're proposing to do on this privately owned riverfront site. I'm not on board with giving you this land. And so on Monday, despite being in opposition to this project, Neutral invited Bauman to speak at the groundbreaking for the first building.
Okay.
And Bauman then walks away after the ceremony, and all the reporters flock to him. And, okay, they started construction here now. Do you believe they can move forward with this other project? And he goes, no, I haven't changed my mind at all. In fact, I really want the city to just rebid the whole thing and break it up. 2.5 acres, if by comparison, doesn't seem large for a suburban house to sit on some lot like that. For a downtown site, that's absolutely huge,
and
which is why Neutral proposed 3 phases. Bauman wants the city to cancel the RFP that it's Mayor Cavalier Johnson's trying to award to Neutral and instead issue 3 new RFPs for 3 different parcels. And he cited the Harley-Davidson Museum, which you can look at and go, oh, the Harley-Davidson Museum, that's great. Well, Harley once proposed 2 other buildings there that were future phases that they canceled. The city feels like it got a bit burned on that deal 20 years ago. He doesn't want that to happen again on this prime downtown site.
So what is he envisioning going there? Still housing, just to different companies?
I don't think he wants a parking lot, which is what his big fear is that, okay, Neutral could come in. Yes, they could build the first phase. And then similar to what happened at the Harley-Davidson Museum on 6th Street, that you end up with just parking lots where other buildings were planned. And you lack the tools to claw back the land. So he still wants an office building, and I don't know if the market really supports that.
Yeah.
That's for developers to decide. The one red other caution he raised was that there was only 3 bidders, and he wanted to see far more bidders. We now know that Newland Enterprises was one of the bidders, the company that built the competing mass timber building, and they've been very public about their concerns with how the city is managing its land sales and its subsidies for workforce housing. So lots of moving pieces.
All right. When we come back, let's talk about granny flat plans. We're with Jeremy Janine. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, and we are talking with Jeremy Janine, president and co-founder of Urban Milwaukee at urbanmilwaukee.com. All right. Not a lot on this one, but as someone who we technically have like a little studio apartment inside of our house. It was built in 2003, so it's not like a traditional granny flat or Polish flat, but it's, I think, an homage to that. But I live in a neighborhood where I think this is very, very common. But what is the difference between a granny flat and a Polish flat?
Sure. So you live in a neighborhood that has many Polish flats.
Okay.
And a Polish flat is named for the immigrant community that Milwaukee that built it. The short version of the story is you would come in, you would build the cheapest house you could, more or less, cheapest quality house. And then when you were ready to earn some extra income, you'd kind of lift up the house and shove another apartment underneath it, which is somewhat similar to what your living arrangement is actually
that is,
like.
That is, yeah, yes. But that, and when you look at, it is interesting because when you look at the houses, so they would physically just like, they'd build it and then they would lift it?
And sometimes the house was built that way and it was unfinished in the basement and progressively you'd finish it, or you know, you just do it off from the get-go. But that's what a Polish flat is.
And it was traditionally you would rent it to someone who wasn't a family member. It would be just like a tenant, like a normal tenant situation.
I think oftentimes they were like not necessarily an immediate family member, but an extended family member, your cousin, whatever. The distinction that when many people say granny flat, what they mean, or they sometimes say in-law suite, carriage house, is the kind of back house, which
so it's a separate building.
Yeah, a separate building. In Milwaukee, those sometimes started as the front house. They picked it up and moved it to the back 100 years ago when house moving was far more common. But then eventually, and you'll see hundreds of examples of this in the city that were built up until about the 1920s, that a smaller house is built in the back. Well, there's now a proposal to re-legalize this. It's been illegal since the 1920s. Very few have been built as a result because you needed this complicated zoning variance and put up all this money in front. I think of like my house in Bayview. I live on an alley that has a big slope, so I could have a garage and a small 600 square foot studio above it. That would be perfect for a grandma to come live in, yeah, or, you know, just to rent it out to someone. But I can't build that legally right now. So there's a proposal to allow that to happen. And the council has now been fighting about it for several months because it seemed really simple. And then the sponsors, Robert Bauman and Jose Perez, were like, oh, no, there's some technical changes in April. They sent it back to committee. Well, the weird thing that happened at the committee meeting earlier this week is now because of an amendment that Scott Spiker, Southside Alderman, pushed through, these four sponsors of the bill, Peter Brigelis, Jocasta Zamarripa, Bauman, and Perez, are now the leading opponents of the bill because Spiker added a substantial restriction, which is to not allow what we're all talking about, the granny flat, the Polish flat. Those are all called accessory dwelling units. You could not add an accessory dwelling unit in a single-family zoned property inside the house. So you could still build that unit in the back, but you could not build that Polish flat that's inside the house anymore. And that has the sponsors being like, no, that's not what we signed up for. We want to legalize this. We know we're in a housing crisis.
Yeah.
We want this
option. All options to be on the table.
Yes. And the argument also is we don't think there's going to be hundreds of people rushing to do this. So if this is a problem, we'll come back and regulate it later. But we want to actually make this option available for people. So next week, we're going to get a real interesting council showdown on Tuesday where, paradoxically, the people that support this proposal the most are going to ask their colleagues not to vote for it so they can get their original version through.
Got it.
So,
all right.
Politics in Milwaukee.
All right. All right. So moving on to something that people who ride the bus may have feelings about. There is cuts or what's happening with transit?
Surprise, they have an $11 million deficit, which is, we'll have an article out shortly after noon on Urban Milwaukee breaking down the county board's reaction to this. We'll also include the detailed routes. But the MCTS budget, which going from memory is somewhere like $180 million, they're projecting annually, they're projecting to be about $11 million short. Now in the middle, and this is an important thing, in the middle of a labor negotiation, they said, oh, we need to cut service because we're $11 million short. Their reasons were, social media commenters were immediately like, well, that's because people get on the bus and they're not paying.
This was literally the conversation I had yesterday as far as, well, yeah, but people aren't, they're just sneaking onto the bus. And I was like, okay.
That is a factor.
Okay.
But it is not one of the top three factors that MCTS is citing. They're citing tariffs, and that applies to bringing in materials to repair buses, just other things you need to operate a transit system. They're also citing, and now I'm trying to go from memory, my colleague Graham Kilmer is reporting on this, mechanic overtime. And then there was one more factor Graham had on. But the key thing to know about the bus system, a lot of people talk about, why don't they just run smaller buses? The most expensive part of running the bus system is the driver.
Yeah.
So regardless of the size of the bus, you're going to have to operate the bus. You're going to have to pay the driver. So MCTS attempts to standardize, but they're going to have to cut 20,000 hours of service. Graham will have the exact percentage of how much of that service that represents and the exact routes that'll be cut coming up.
Do we have any estimation of how many people this will impact?
It's like, I'm a freaking bus rider. If they cut one of the bus runs every hour, I'm still going to ride the bus. I'm just going to wait longer.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to have to change my schedule. So it's going to impact a lot of people. But is it going to cause them not to ride the bus? I don't know. Until you stack that up year after year after year. So the question is this $11 million gap a one-time thing? Is it a labor negotiation strategy? Or is it something that's going to be sustained every year that, oh, the transit system's in a death spiral?
How close do you think we are to, like, Waymo buses?
It seems like we're a ways away. And I think not only
because we got the taxis.
And we don't have them in Wisconsin.
We don't have them in Wisconsin. I'm saying they are here, though. Like, they're like the taxis, like the driverless taxis are a technology that is being used in different cities. And so do you feel like that's eventually where we have like driverless buses, if that's the most expensive part of a transit system?
I think that's a realistic option. I think that's on the table. I think not only though figuring out the technology, I don't believe Waymo's in any cities that it snows in yet.
Oh, that's a good point.
And which is like, you think about, they use all these sensors. Well, if the sensors are sensing a road that's covered, like, it's just not going to work as well. And so they're working on that technology. Obviously Google and who owns Waymo and all these other companies
Tesla,
are aware
of
this. Yeah. The bigger consideration, and it might not be as big an issue in Milwaukee, but when you look at like a Chicago, the politics of it, the union of bus drivers is a strong union, and you'd be saying, yeah, we're going to eliminate a lot of those jobs. Mm-hmm. Transit unions have long struggled with this. Commuter railroad systems that have conductors on it that check tickets and stuff, is that all necessary? We see at the hop that they didn't pay for conductors and fare boxes because they thought it'd be more expensive than just letting people ride for free. Can you apply that same logic with self-driving buses? We'll see. I think it's a discussion we'll be having.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. When we come back, we're going to update on trampolines and whether or not you can have one in your yard. Stay with us on Point Taken. All right. So we talked about this last week when you were on with Steve and I, Jeremy Janine of Urban Milwaukee, as far as potential new regulations on where you can put your trampoline. And there's an update there?
There's an update. Well, so it was this time last week. I was on the air with you guys when the committee meeting was actually happening.
Okay.
So we now have the details. We have more. It just seems like a funny... It's both a serious topic in some regards and an absurdity in other regards. And I need to be an objective journalist here, and I will allow you to comment.
Okay, I'm better at that.
Alderman Peter Virgelis is proposing to enshrine in law, with penalties of up to $500 for fines, where you can place your trampoline in Milwaukee. That the police wouldn't come cite you, but the Department of Neighborhood Services inspectors could come issue a citation. So if you don't have a net on your trampoline, it would have to be, and this is for trampolines, in excess of 20 square feet. They would have to be 15 feet away from several different obstructions, buildings, trees. His inspiration was a constituent complained and sent in a photo of a picket fence next to a trampoline.
And you have that on your article on urbanmilwaukee.com.
And I think we can all agree, clear common sense, like, yeah, it'd be bad to jump on a trampoline next to a picket fence. You're just asking for trouble. That's the regulations without a net. You can be much closer if you have a net. It turned out through some just good gumshoe journalism, pulling up Google Maps, that Peter Virgelis lives next to a house that has a trampoline. Now, he then later told me that he's never heard anyone jumping on that trampoline and that he believes it's a grandmother that has it for her grandkids. And then he told me over the weekend that a net did go up on it, so that trampoline is more protected.
So his worry is danger, as far as it, like, kids jumping off into dangerous objects because the trampoline is too close to other structures.
Other restrictions included in this proposal: you can't use your trampoline between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. Okay. So don't get up before school and jump on your trampoline or stay up late and have a party. You also have to abide by the maintenance instructions that are included in your manufacturer agreement. I think that's a literal squeaky wheel type thing where they're like, oh, it's really noisy. Well, you didn't maintain it. This is where you can opine about how serious we should be about regulating trampolines.
It does not seem like the highest priority to me right now. I also don't feel like I see that many trampolines in the city of Milwaukee. So how many people is this actually affecting?
That's a fair question. Peter Virgelis represents a Southwest Side district.
Okay.
So about the most, other than the far Northwest Side, about the most suburban style you could get in Milwaukee.
So maybe more around him. I have not seen a single trampoline. Well, I don't know. I just don't feel like this is again, when you're in the suburbs, I certainly see a lot of trampolines. I just don't see that many trampolines in the city. So it just does not feel like it rises to the occasion of where emphasis and time and resources should be going. But maybe still more important than the other thing Alderman Peter Virgelis has brought back, which is Milwaukee's flag.
We're restarting the flag conversation. Here we go again. Just kind of a background on the flag real quick. There's a 1954, Milwaukee approves a new flag, and this is how we get in this awkward situation. The flag that was created in 1954, it's blue if you're searching for it today. It is an amalgamation of a bunch of different entries into a design contest. So there was an artist who was also an alderman who the city had a design contest. They didn't pick a winner, but he goes, well, I'll take a stab at it. And he just takes elements. So you got County Stadium, you got City Hall, you have a flag on the flag. You have, and this is one of the problematic elements, you have a Native American and war headdress, which is an homage to the then Milwaukee Braves. There is a big gear. So there's some clear Milwaukee symbolism, but it's by all standards of vexillology, which is the art of designing flags. It is a messy flag. There was a contest 2001. All the design submissions were rejected. This is a formal city contest. Then in 2015, Roman Mars, the podcaster, gives a great quote, and I don't have it in front of me at the moment, but the city of Milwaukee's flag was rated third worst in the country. And he at this TED Talk, shined a light on Milwaukee's flag as this insult to vexillology, just for how messy it is. So 2016, Steve Kotes does an unofficial design contest, and here's the problem. He does an unofficial design contest, gets 1,000 entries, then Mayor Tom Barrett and then Common Council President Ashanti Hamilton show up in support. Contest is at City Hall, but it's unofficial, and it doesn't include things like Spanish language translation. It's all done online to collect the submissions. And out of that comes the sunrise over the lake, the blue and yellow flag that is flown all kinds of places. Now, the arguments that have... Going back to 2018, then Alderman Cavalier Johnson was like, let's adopt this flag. Now all of a sudden we end up with Cavalier Johnson being like, I don't think we should adopt this flag. I'm sorry for the absurdity of all this description. Because there are questions about that 2016 design process and how inclusive it was, if it represented the whole community. And then there are questions of, yes, like the Brewers are using the People's Flag. Tom Barrett supported the People's Flag. And it's called the People's Flag because it's unofficial. That you can see it on beer cans, you can see it on t-shirts and all kinds of other stuff, that it's not flown in the middle of the city. And Steve, who's not here today, he flies at No Creek even, where it's nowhere close to being the official flag. But the People's Flag is everywhere except in the places that aldermen want to see it. So unfortunately, we have this racial divide over this 2016 contest, which there seems no way to really resolve. So last year, Peter Bergelis, newcomer to the council, says, hey, let's adopt the flag. It's everywhere. Runs into the same roadblocks that happened in 2018. This year he's back, but he says, let's do a design contest
instead. All right, let's take a break and we'll talk about what the design contest is. After this, we're talking to Jeremy Janine on Point Taken. All right, we got about 2 minutes left with Jeremy Janine. So what is the new contest for the flag, for context here?
The Common Council next week will vote to, it appears next week, will vote to establish this committee, 9-member committee, appointees from the Milwaukee Arts Board, the Mayor's Office, and the Common Council. It's 9 members. That committee will be in charge within 4 months. There's no fiscal note yet, so there's no city money being spent, which is, might raise other questions in the future. Within 4 months has to not only host a design contest, but then rank the 10 best options.
Who gets to rank it?
These 9 people on this committee.
And is it aldermen on the committee, or is it actual people who know, like, have an eye for design?
It'll be appointees of the Common Council, of the mayor, and of the arts board.
So it's not Bauman with his Canva login that's going to be judging this?
Here comes the real problem. At the end of the day, this committee is going to rank these 10 options. It then has to send them back to the Common Council, where the flag issue has always gone to die. And the 15 council members are going to not only get a recommendation that this is the best, but they might get 10 flags to look at, and they could then go, well, the task force said we'd like number one, but we're actually going to pick number two, which could create the scenario that Milwaukee ends up with 3 flags. The flag it's had since the 1950s, the unofficial people's flag, and the new official flag, whatever it may be. So stay tuned. The next 4 months could be interesting.
All right. I mean, at least it's very ripe for jokes. And so that it's content that will live on and keeps on giving. So we'll take a win as a win.
The best case scenario is the people's flag wins, so we don't end up in that 3-flag scenario. We're at least down to 2 flags, and there might be a clear winner.
All right. As always, so fun to talk to you, Jeremy Janine. Check out his work at urbanmilwaukee.com. I will be back on Monday. You have Tracy Johnson in tomorrow with Bill and Joe. Have a great weekend, and happy Juneteenth.